Case 84 from the Blue Cliff Record. Vimalakirti's Gate of Non-Duality. The Pointer. Though you say it is, there is nothing which is can affirm. Though you say it is not, there is nothing that is not can negate. When is and is not are left behind, and gain and loss are forgotten, then you are clean and naked, free and at ease. But tell me, who is in front of you and in back of you? If there is a patch-robed monk who comes forward and says, in the front is the Buddha shrine and the main gate, and behind is the abbot's sleeping quarters and private quarters, tell me, does this person have eyes or not? If you can judge this person, I'll allow that you have personally seen the ancients. The case. Vimalakirti asked Manjushri, what is a bodhisattva's entry into the Dharma gate of non-duality? Manjushri said, according to what I think, in all things no words, no speech, no demonstration, and no recognition, to leave behind all questions and answers. This is entering the Dharma gate of non-duality. Then Manjushri asked Vimalakirti, we have each spoken, now you should tell us, good man, what is a bodhisattva's entry into the Dharma gate of non-duality? Shwedo said, what did Vimalakirti say? He also said, completely exposed. And the verse, bah to old Vimalakirti. Out of compassion for living beings, he suffers an empty affliction. Lying ill in Visali, his whole body withered and emaciated. Manjushri, the teacher of seven Buddhas, comes to the single room that's been swept repeatedly. He asks about the gate of non-duality, then Vimalakirti leans and falls. He doesn't lean and fall. The golden-haired lion has no place to look. So already our third day of retreat, or maybe more. Certainly we do go to the place for me, any retreat, 1 day, 3 days, 7 days, that we spoke of last night, this place of beyond. For me, this morning, I woke up before the wake-up bell in a completely dark room, and I had no idea where I was. Lying there in some bed, I could not remember what was going on. And slowly I began to realize that, oh, this was my bed. kind of how it is, right? Where am I? Where am I? Right here. Right here. But this loosening is both quite disturbing. If I'm not who I thought I was, who am I? How will I amuse myself if I don't tell the same stories, those great chestnuts about who I am? What will become of me? And of course, some great joy. We've been speaking so much of illness and death and In our culture, death is swept under the rug. The fear is so high. Aging is just seen as a problem that we try to remediate, get the right creams and the right vitamins. And yet, for me, actually, when Kate told her first story about that person on this ski hill who just turned out to be an old man. I had a moment of concern as I approached that that position myself. Although I still consider myself a young old man, so not there yet, but within spitting distance, as we say. Many of us here in this room growing a little long in the tooth, aren't we? and yet so often seen and feels a problem, my joints, my energy. But yet also some great gift, this getting old, this getting tired. Finally you can rest. How wonderful to be at every phase. How wonderful to be a child, to not even know that you're a child. You're just running, just in your room reading. No sense of being a child. How wonderful. And then we become a teenager. How terrible. and how wonderful. We go through our incredible difficulty. Who am I? How do I stack up? Where will I go? How will I figure out my life? And young adult and middle adult. Every phase has its own wonderful challenge. And this getting old and dying, I think, doubly difficult in a culture that denies any value. Oh, yeah, you're old, you're retired, you're you are not really a person. But this getting old, sinking into ourselves, there is this freedom day after day, some beginning of a possibility. One thing, it's possible not to care so much about what others think. Not that we don't want to care what other people think, we just don't have enough energy to care what other people think anymore. What a wonderful thing. And then this dying, such a fear, such a taboo against dying. Fight the good fight, think good thoughts, beat your illness. And of course, life and death always win. This reality, and this death, this dying, also has the aspect of liberation. Right, and it is liberation we are about here. This liberation, this freedom from ourself. We often say that this is not, that Zen is not a self-improvement project. Of course, it's important to grow in our love and understanding and to act as skillfully as we can, and perhaps through this work we can be slightly less reactive. We can perhaps do more good in the world, and this is wonderful. But ultimately, a better self won't help you. A better self then is just another burden to carry around. Well, now I've been sitting Zen for 35 years. I better be better than I am. Right? Of course, I should be. But you will never be better than you are. So this dying, this giving up that several people have spoken to is required. Not optional for us human beings, and not optional on this path. This liberation, I think it's the Okamura passage, talks about, do not think it is you who does this work and you who will be awakened, and that enlightenment will be another merit badge. And you can wear it proudly. You can be quite modest about it too. I'm awakened and I don't have to tell everybody because it's so obvious, I'm sure. off we go. There is awakening, and each one of you know this. There is entry into the non-dual, and don't imagine, as Josh said last night, don't imagine that it is somewhere else and that you may get it someday. You will never get it. There is... There's nothing to be gotten. There really isn't. How wonderful you can stop trying to get something. Or you can keep trying to get something. And in this great freedom that is already here, you don't score more points for not trying to get something than you score for trying to get something. Point total exactly even. So how do we live in a world without keeping score? How do we play ping-pong, not to 21, but for the joy of the little white ball bouncing back and forth? The ball comes to you, maybe a difficult shot, maybe you totally miss, hit the ball over the fence, have to go to the neighbor's yard to get it. Your partner's laughing at you one more time. How wonderful to be a human being. How terrible to be a human being. I wouldn't wish it on anyone. And yet here we are. And yet here we are. This entering, always entering, entering though we have been here forever, being born, dying, dying again and again, being ground down, being tenderized by our practice. And each of us gives our heart to what we love. This is not a matter of willpower. Willpower is a very weak force in the universe. Don't imagine if you had more willpower, your
Zen would be better. It would probably be worse. So we head toward what we love. We keep our eyes open. These teachings, we do not believe them, but we consider, what if it's true? What if there isn't something else to get? What if it's right here? Right here.
I'm really feeling for Manjushri, who had to muster something to say. This Dharma gate of not two that is entered by all bodhisattvas. In fact, cannot be entered. We say immediately affirm not to. But even that is too much. The Hangzhe piece we read today said, non-mind enacts and fulfills the way of non-mind, and finally you can rest. The Dharma gate of not two is not entered by some trick you do with your mind. The non-doable practice, the non-doable non-practice of Shikantaza is immediately affirming not to. It is entering in this moment. Not to. Not to is not an experience. It's not a feeling of oneness. Not to is the fact of the matter. This is not to. And in Zazen, we just entrust ourselves to the free fall of that reality. Arisings of mind are not diseases in need of antidote. Nor, by the way, are diseases in need of antidote. Yun Men said, medicine and sickness heal each other. What arises in your mind in Zazen, what arises in this mind that is not yours, in this Zazen that is not yours, none of it is a problem. None of it is a truth. And none of it is a problem. They are just arisings. One way we enter the Dharma gate of not two in Zazen is by receiving all arisings. Stories, aversions, graspings, thoughts, fantasies, sensations, ache, pains, rocks, walls, hedges, and trees, we receive all arisings into the same one category. Stuff that arises. We meet it all equally. Because of causes and conditions, at some points, we may dive into stories, get lost in fantasies. And there is no choice point there. When there's no space for choice, there's no space for choice. And then at some point awareness arises. And the content of that awareness is, oh my gosh, in those other moments I was doing a thing. That actually has nothing to do with those other moments. That moment is arising right here. This moment, this mental formation whose content is a story about prior mental formations. And nothing needs to be fixed. No antidote needs to be applied. Continuing, entrusting yourself to the universe's zazen. Not created by you. Doesn't start when you start making effort, doesn't stop when you stop. It is unrelated to willpower or skill or content of consciousness. The Dharma gate of not to is vast. Vast. So vast it can't even be entered. What if you were to let this be enough? What if your certainty that this is not enough is not a special kind of problem, not a special kind of truth? It's just the arising of the experience of, this can't possibly be enough. And what if those momentary experiences of, oh yeah, it's really enough. What if that's not any more true than anything else? Non-mind enacts and fulfills the way of non-mind. This is our zazen. This is the zazen of body, breath, mind, and universe. Medicine and sickness heal each other, and we immediately affirm not to, even with to.
So we invite you to sit comfortably where you are. As possible, and we will
begin our Dharma dialogue. Yeah.
This idea of Vimalakirti sick, is he feigning, is he sulking, all these different... is Vimalakirti sick, is he feigning, is he sulking? And then, does it matter? And could that be one of the entries of this non-dual that is all together? What Josh was saying about meeting everything as it arises, that's what he was doing with all the bodhisattvas, entering this room that was too small and so large. And his silence is another example of the non-dual. When you were talking, all of a sudden it made sense to me. Now I'm talking, it doesn't make sense.
Thank you.
And I appreciate your naming this room that is not small and too large. This is that room. This body is that room.
And also so there's a glimmer and it opens and we see, oh, it is feigning, not feigning, everything is included. And then we try to pin it down. Okay, I got it. Now we'll nail that sucker to the wall. And of course, it doesn't do that. So thank you for this demonstration.
The traditional one image from the Zen tradition of that, trying to nail it to the wall. Sometimes it's called capturing the spring breeze in a bottle. Whatever bottle you have, doesn't matter how well constructed, how big it is, how much of a funnel you have to really get the spring breeze in there, whatever you get in the bottle and put the cork on, that's not the spring breeze. And there's a spring breeze.
Mark?
David, I can't stop and I won't stop until I die.
Yeah, and maybe not stop even then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. But I hope not. I think, of course, it's not a matter of willpower, but part of our great Zen spirit is onward. You know, if you think you've got the spring breeze, I'm sorry for you. But if you're willing to march forward, one more shot, you know. I'm going to get it. This is our spirit, and whether we think it's working or not is totally beside the point. Right? There's just this great spirit. Yeah. Thanks. Alan?
So I wanted to say I've really been appreciating all this attention to Vimalakirti, partly because he's one of our most important lay ancestors. And we don't hear very much, you know, here at Sishin about the great lay ancestors like Vimalakirti and the Pong family, Lama Pong and Rinpoche Pong and Ling Zhao. And these are really important ancestors for me because, as you know, I'm really committed to the idea of lay practice. And one thing about the Vimalakirti Sutra that's kind of been touched on the edges but not been really central is that in addition to embodying this project of liberation that you spoke about so movingly, you know, it's also there's also a project of social liberation in that text. Hierarchies, you know, along with the dualisms that support them are being demolished. And so the lay Buddhist is able to confound all the chief disciples of the Buddha and the Bodhisattvas. And the well-swept little room, you know, holds not just all the people you mentioned, but all these gods and goddesses that come to all these devas. And there's also this amazing part about the Bodhisattva goddess who has this debate with Shariputra about gender and completely, you know, and as we know, female practitioners have been held down, if it needed at all, you know, for most of the history of Buddhism, most times and places. But in this sutra, the the Bodhisattva goddess completely demolishes that, and even demolishes the notion that gender is anything but a social construct, and that there's some essential masculinity and femininity. So I just want to announce that, you know, put it up there, because in our political moment, maybe this is an important aspect of that sutta that's gotten some attention. And, you know, if any of you want to address that, that's great. And if you don't, then I just wanted the Sangha, you know, to have that door open.
Alan, I really appreciate you bringing that up. And, you know, what I realized is that we have these hierarchies, and at the same time, what happens in this Dharma dialogue is that we teach each other, that people will give these amazing Dharma talks in three sentences in the Sangha, and everyone's head is just turned around. And that is truly what we are enacting here. And at the same time, we have to keep being mindful of how we encounter hierarchy, inequality, keeping other people down, but to really remember what we're doing here as a Sangha, which is to constantly be showing up, to be sharing our Dharma light with each other.
And to reiterate something that I think probably can't be said enough, that this is not and cannot be a personal project. So not here in the Zendo as we're working, and as we go out into the world as lay people, our bodhisattva vow is not to get clear understanding so my life can be easier. But each one of us to go out and see what we see in the world, and to meet it and do something with our whole heart. And I think this sutra, thank you for mentioning that. I think it's so important to say.
So I have a sort of just a question. It's about public perception of Zen, okay? And I run into this pretty often, and I just want your thoughts on it. It's about the idea that somehow in Zen you empty your mind, you know, that there is this realm of no thought, and that's like what we spend or what we're striving toward.
Oh, a little louder.
I'm sorry, did they not hear it? Yeah, okay. So there's this public perception, okay, that in Zen, or in meditation in general, that you're trying to empty your mind. That somehow it's the no-thought mind state that's somehow best, or somehow an end goal, okay? And it's very hard for me to describe to people that that's not what we're about. And then, all of a sudden, then I get into this loophole. Okay, what do I tell them? Okay, so...
What do you tell them?
I just sit, and it's like, okay, but what are you doing? And, you know, it's like, what are you doing, you know? So,
Yeah, that's quite to the point.
Vimla Kirti. You know, one of the things I find, because people ask me all the time, yeah. Boy, your mind must be so calm. And it's like, oh my God, if they knew. But I think this... It comes from this longing for this not to be it, right? There has to be some peaceful state where thoughts don't arrive. This can't be it. Not my mind. So you must be having no thoughts because you went on this week-long retreat. And the longing springs eternal, I think, in all of us for this not to be it.
I, as to what to tell your friends, I have no idea. And our ancestor Kazan says, if you want to speak 10 times, keep quiet 9. And I'm going to speak. you have no idea, those 9.
Yeah.
Melissa does. So this business of empty your mind, it is not a thing. The gate of non-duality is the reality that this mind full of stuff is itself the very functioning and manifestation of emptiness. It's not that we get to some state of no thought. Thought itself is no thought. Presentations themselves are no presentation. Form, it turns out, is exactly emptiness. And emptiness is exactly form. And so what does it mean to sit amid that reality?
Hold
up. Yeah.
Since this is a silent retreat and I've been silent most of the time, I will offer some concrete reflection on that, if that's okay. As a therapist in a tradition that is very much aligned with Zen, although I don't tell them that, so they don't come away, we often practice mindfulness meditation, and I found through my practice that it's a wonderful opportunity to help not only develop a mindful awareness of noticing, returning, but also as an illustration of what many people understand as the Serenity Prayer. Because it's exactly these things that we, like Josh said so beautifully, we cannot control. We cannot control that, but we can control how we attempt to return and how we treat ourselves as we return. And to make this connection between the two was, you know, just like, oh, wow, these two things that were kind of separate in my mind, just kind of joined, and people get that, because that's important anyway to know. Because people underestimate what control they have, and they feel needlessly vulnerable and helpless, and they overestimate how much control they have, and they feel balanced. So getting into that third line of that prayer, whether you put God in front of it or not, it's not important, is the essence of a lot of the work that I do. And so getting into that is there. And so I tell people, you do not have control. Oh, and this is from one of my teachers here. You do not have control when that happens, or how long it happens, or how intensely, or what's going on, but you do have control. And you don't have control when you notice it.
Well,
that's what I've learned from this tradition and from my teacher.
Yeah, and I think that's so well put, and I think we're really studying that here. I love what you say about how we don't own the power we have to turn toward it, and we overestimate the power to control it. So that, I think that really is, and we get to see that up close and personal. Right?
And I just want to acknowledge that I received that from my daughter's son.
Yeah.
Wednesday night.
Yeah, great. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, great. Thank you. Sure.
I just wanted to ask, to make sure that I understand this properly. When you said, Josh, that this Dharma gate cannot be entered, did you also mean that this Dharma gate cannot be not entered?
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Actually, in the title, one of our koan collections is called the Mumon Khan, and sometimes translated as the gateless gate or the gateless barrier. Mumon, no gate, and Khan is barrier, but it also means a checkpoint, like the checkpoint between provinces or countries where you have to present your papers, right? And so one translation of the no gate checkpoint is the free pass checkpoint, right? There's no gate there to enter. Just keep going. So it sometimes feels like the gateless barrier, up against it, nowhere to go. And other times we see, what is all this nonsense about a barrier? Right? Yeah. Yeah, somebody. Great. Yeah. Hey.
I just had a similar thought when David brought up willpower. It definitely struck me that people, when I go on this retreat, they're like, wow, you must have a lot of willpower.
A little louder?
You must have a lot of willpower. And I'm like, you know, that's definitely not it. And yet my mind so wants to make up a story about how I'm here and they're not. You know, like, oh, well, then what is it? I must have caused kind of Zen bug. And you know, of course, it's causes and conditions, but it's definitely a great mystery. How we are here and other people are not, and yet no willpower, no extra willpower, definitely.
Yeah. You're also, so we're here because, as you say, of causes and conditions and our karma, which we are not responsible for, and we cannot take credit for. And yet, we sign up for a retreat and we come. Someone once said to our Dharma ancestor, John Tarrant, that, I think I'm too lazy to practice Zen. And John Tarrant said, maybe you're not lazy enough.
And Faye, I appreciate what you say about this mystery. It feels like it's one of that at the center, we can sense there is some reason we're here, and we cannot know what it is, right? And this dharma we talk about, this gateway into the non-dual. For me, mystery is a wonderful placeholder, because it talks about some aliveness. So something is happening. Here we are, and we don't really know why. But yet, I do think for all of us to have some intention as we're here, have some direction, is important. You know, what is it we're really here for? So we ask the question, and part of the answer is, I don't know. And it's not never a fixed position. So I appreciate you naming the mystery that arises.
Yeah, but you know, I just want to add that mystery, that sense of I have no idea how it is that I'm here and other people are not, makes it all the more precious. There's something about not knowing and the wild coincidences that brought me here that make it incredibly valuable and something just to be treasured for what it is.
Yeah. And the great responsibility that brings.
Yeah.
We have to practice for all the ones who aren't here, who can't be here, who won't be here. This is a great responsibility that we take on.
I wanted to appreciate Alan's comment too, about the social implications of religion. And I've been feeling that a lot. I every now and then on Kinhan, like North Korea comes to mind, and like I heard the sound of something going, and I was like, I just feel so precarious in this world right now. And I know we've had some pretty terrible presidents in American history, but it's really apparent to me that you can have the head of an entire group be a complete asshole, and nothing in the system prevents that. And it's been coming up for me, actually, in the lineage dedication. I'm like, I don't know these people. Who are these people? And I've been wondering why I've like hated the lineage dedication so much. But I don't know them. They could be anyone. They could have gotten there through their merit and their insight, or they could have been a special favorite. We know that happens in Zen, too. That's not just... So I need some help with the lineage dedication and why we do it. We're all bodhisattva teachers. Why these people's names? Yeah. Mostly men.
Not mostly men.
I thought G.U. Kennett was the lady.
Oh, it's true. Yeah. Yeah, it's true. Yeah. G.U. Kennett and her teacher.
Okay. No, was a man.
A man. No. Okay.
Just G.U. Kennett.
G.U. Kennett, yeah. One.
One.
For me... That lineage dedication is one of the dedications we do. There are other dedications, but there is something that has been passed down. And I don't suspect that all of the people named in that lineage dedication were wonderful, blameless people. It does seem that even great wisdom doesn't spare you from blindness, and so as we chant, for me, maybe it's acknowledging that there is some tradition, some things were said and written down, and there is some tradition that we are trying to own, and these people that we name are people who, like us, who have done their best and have encountered this. And may we receive what we can receive and pass on this tradition in a way that is alive and true now. It's not about we have to imitate how they did it, but maybe more like Mark was saying. These are people who have given their life to justice and liberation. As best they could in some flawed way. So for me, as I chant, it's that spirit and gratitude for something has been transmitted that has been quite helpful for me.
Yeah, I just want to underscore what David's pointing to about the what gets transmitted is not personal. It's not about people. The triple treasure is independent of who transmits it. But very fragile. And you're talking about, what if we have someone at the head of our government who might ruin the whole thing, or a missile might? What we see is the fragility of these treasures, the fragility of the treasures of what we value in our government, in our society, right? The fragility of what we value in Zen. Hard to guarantee even a morning or an evening. And I think in some ways that helps me with why we pay so much attention to reminding ourselves how of transmission, of what's gotten passed down, of how it's been guarded. That there's a reason why we have to guard it. It is fragile. It does get lost. It can get lost. And so we say that dedication.
Yeah.
There exists a dedication, not in our... So the version of the dedication we do is a very idiosyncratic to us version. Like normally it is a in the Sotsa tradition, it's a recitation of all of the 52 generations of ancestors from teacher to student, so which is more recently semi-factual and more distantly not so much. But there also exists As Diane actually reminded me recently, the Soto Zen Buddhist Association of America, they now have there's a women's ancestral lineage pointing to this way that there's the systemic erasure of some people's experience and some people's contributions and the alienization of others. And for me, the spirit of that dedication, irrespective of the potentially problematic content of it, is a recollecting that I am not here by my own doing. I am not here on my own merits. And this is also what we acknowledge with the Oryoki chant, when we reflect on the efforts and indeed the lives that have brought us this food. And when we reflect on the four benefactors, this is teachers, parents, nations, societies, and cultures, and all sentient beings. Those are the four benefactors, the four classes of benefactors that enable us to have this bowl of rice. And connecting and reminding ourselves of this is in vast, unknowable aggregate is really important, and also again for me underscores the responsibility I have to all beings.
I just had a very brief comment on the previous thread. There was about why we do Zen and why we're here, and maybe others aren't. But just a little line from the sutra we just chanted in the sutra service says, "Where this takes me, I will go." And, you know, in some unfathomable way, we are carried along, and yet we accept the commitment to be where we are.
So let's once more accept the commitment to be where we are.